From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. And now to the least likely sponsorship in Olympic sports. Tonight, the comedian Stephen Colbert plans to again feature the U.S. speed skating team on his TV show. Colbert decided to sponsor the team after it lost a major corporate backer to bankruptcy. NPR's Howard Berkus reports on this mix of comedy and competition.
The bankrupt bank left a $300,000 hole in U.S. speed skating's ice just as the big push to next month's Olympics began. Then came the phone call from New York and the November 2nd cable cast of the Colbert Report.
Okay, Bob, is this possible? Can the Colbert Nation sponsor U.S. speed skating?
Yes, absolutely.
Where do I sign?
Right here.
That was U.S. speed skating CEO Bob Crowley getting Stephen Colbert's signature on the sponsorship papers.
Our budget would have had to have been cut in a number of key areas. For U.S. speed skating, this has been a lifesaver, literally.
Now, Stephen Colbert didn't put up any of his own money. Instead, he begged his viewers to send in checks.
We have got to step up and make sure that it is America's 38-inch thighs on that metal platform.
Speed skating is now part of Colbert's blustering comic send-ups of real bloviating talk show hosts. Here he is with short track medal prospect Catherine Reuter.
Let's trash talk the summer games for just a second.
Let's do it.
Guys like Michael Phelps, how easy is it to swim through water? You run on top of water with samurai swords strapped to your feet.
Thank you. Doesn't that seem harder? Definitely.
Reuter is a very serious, hard-training skater who can describe in exquisite detail the technical, physical, and psychological challenges of her sport.
I always want to present myself as a poised athlete, someone who is intelligent and hardworking, and I want for people to be able to relate to me in that way.
Colbert did ask Reuter about her training regimen, and then she asked him to sign his name on her billboard thighs, as she freely calls them. Stunts like that make some wonder whether skaters lose their dignity with the Colbert connection. Long track star Shani Davis called Colbert a jerk. Trip Mickle is the Olympic beat writer for Sports Business Journal.
You got to be weary of partnering with people who might make these sports sticky almost, you know, just something that they aren't, and make them too much about a joke and not about what they really are.
And when Sports Illustrated put a speed skater on its cover, it wasn't Catherine Reuter. It was Stephen Colbert, head-to-toe in a skin-tight Team USA racing suit. But Mickle believes Colbert has not crossed the line so far, and Reuter agrees.
At the very beginning, we were all a little worried that maybe he'd poke fun at us. We didn't want our life dream to be turned into something that got poked fun at on Comedy Central, but that has never happened. Like, I feel like I have more support and more people believe in me because of this show.
The sponsorship has had its challenges. At first, Colbert wanted his face on those billboard thighs, but given their varied dimensions and the flexed material, well, he'd have cheeks stretch wide like silly putty. So he went for the Colbert Nation logo instead. And then there's the nasty diss from Shani Davis.
I challenge you to a speed skating race. Any rink, any time, any distance. As long as I get a 1,000-meter head start. If I win, I get your spot on the U.S. Olympic team. But if you win, you get an autographed copy of my Sports Illustrated cover.
Colbert and Davis did race, and the results are shown on tonight's show. Close to 10,000 Colbert viewers sent in more than $300,000, making up for the bankrupt bank. But this is a one-time-only deal. U.S. speed skating still has to find a real sponsor with a long-term commitment. There's hope that the Colbert Report's exposure will make that easier. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Now we're going back to the dark ages to learn something about the American economy today. We often hear that America's global dominance is coming to an end, and history offers a scary model, Rome. When Rome fell, Europe collapsed into the miserable dark ages. But as Hannah Jaffe Walt and Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money explain, the dark ages might not have been so dark, economically speaking.
Do you want to know why we've all been taught that the Dark Ages were so dark? It's all about spices.
Spices can tell you a clear, quick economic story. You walk into a spice store.
Like Penzi's in Grand Central Station in Manhattan.
So here we see ginger from China, anise seeds from Spain, caraway seeds from Holland.
This is Tom Standage. He wrote An Edible History of Humanity. And he says, look at this. You have spices from all over the world. Clearly, you're trading with the whole world. You're doing well.
Ancient Rome was like that, too. They also loved spices. Maybe more than us. They smothered their food with them.
Delicious. But then it's the Dark Ages. From around 500 to around 1000 AD, all after Rome fell, dinner was bland, and so was lunch. Spices, or at least any evidence of them, almost completely disappears.
Well, if you can't see the spices, it's a question of, you know, is absence of evidence evidence of absence? And does it mean that trade really has fallen off?
Well, that's exactly the question we are trying to figure out today. So now we have to leave the spice store. We have to go back to the studio and talk to Michael McCormick. He's a historian at Harvard who thinks he's found some alternatives to spices to figure out just what was going on in the Dark Ages.
Rats are fantastic. I'm talking about the black rat, Rattus rattus.
Rat bones. McCormick tells us rat bones are completely changing our view of the Dark Ages.
That's because if they didn't have spices, it doesn't necessarily mean that Europeans in the Dark Ages were not trading with the rest of the world. Rat bones, it seems, prove that, in fact, they were.
Because rats like to go where people go.
They like us. They're very fond of us. They like to be close to us, right, as you may have noticed.
Right. We don't like them very much, but they like
us. The feeling's not mutual.
See, Rattus rattus, the black rat, is not particularly ambitious.
No, they won't travel more than a few hundred feet from where they're born, at least not on their own 4 feet.
They don't mind being transported passively, especially if they're in a nice, dark, moist place with lots of grain, like the bottom of a ship.
So, a rat is born in, say, Alexandria, Egypt, rides a trading ship to Italy, dies, and 1,500 years later, some archaeology grad student digs up its tiny little bones, and suddenly, we know. Someone in Egypt was trading with someone in Italy.
For centuries, we had so little information about the economy of the Dark Ages. We had almost no spices. There were so few texts having anything to do with economics. Right, Mike?
Very few texts.
And so all the big historians, the textbooks I read in college.
Yeah, same for me.
Yeah, they all assumed, hey, they had no spices. They weren't writing about trade. They must have been broke, isolated, sad little economies.
But then those rat bones showed there was all sorts of trade going on.
And not just rat bones. There's this new diving technology, and we've been finding all these shipwrecks from that period.
The internet, also new innovation, has transformed scholarly collaboration.
There are new discoveries all the time, big ones.
Well, I got an email, and the email was headed, wow, with an incredible number of exclamation marks after it. And I nearly fell off my chair. I never have expected to see anything like this.
Kevin Leahy is from the British Museum, and he's talking about the mother of all So You Think You Knew the Dark Ages discoveries.
You might remember this one. Just last summer, they found 1,800 gold pieces from 7th century Anglo-Saxon England. This one find is something like 3 times bigger than all the artifacts from that period combined.
And it and the rat bones and the text all have one clear message. These early medieval folks, who we've all pitied all these years, so broke and alone, they were rich.
At least richer than we thought they were.
Yeah, and they were doing business all over the globe.
At least the part of the globe that they knew about.
The Dark Ages really are all misnamed.
They weren't so dark. And they weren't all that sunny either.
Let's call them gray.
The Gray Ages. And let's keep looking for rat bones. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Hannah Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking, including customer service with a real human being 24/7. Learn more at allybank.com.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block in Washington.
And from California, I'm Madeline Brand. I'll be hosting for the next 2 weeks.
And it's great to hear you again on the program, Madeline. Welcome back.
Well, thanks, Melissa. It's great to be back. And let's check in with politics today. We're waiting for the outcome of the Massachusetts Senate race. That could decide the fate of the health care overhaul bill in Washington. And if he wins, Republican Scott Brown has vowed to become the key vote to block a final version of the bill. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, Democrats are scrambling for Plan B.
At his weekly briefing with reporters this morning, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer insisted that negotiations between the House and Senate on a final health bill are proceeding on schedule.
I'm not going to anticipate or speculate or hypothesize on what may or may not happen in Massachusetts today. I am very hopeful, and my expectation is that Attorney General Coakley will be elected to the United States Senate.
That would be Martha Coakley, the Democratic candidate who's lost a double-digit lead in the polls in the past few weeks. But behind the scenes, Democrats have been scrambling to put together options to pass a health overhaul bill if Coakley loses. The easiest option is to simply finish the current negotiations and get a bill to the president. They should have about 2 weeks before the Massachusetts election is certified. Hoyer didn't hesitate when he was asked if he thought negotiations could be done by then.
Yes.
After that, though, things get considerably less simple. The next option, says Bill Hoagland,
you could have the House hold their nose and vote for the Senate-passed bill and get it to the president with the understanding that through forthcoming must-pass legislation, you start making modifications to the Senate-passed bill.
Hoagland, a longtime Senate Republican budget aide and now a lobbyist for insurance giant Cigna, says he doesn't consider that option very likely. That's because there are so many aspects of the Senate bill that House Democrats don't like. The Senate bill, for example, doesn't have a government-sponsored insurance option. It includes a controversial tax on high-cost health plans, and it's far less generous in terms of subsidies for lower-middle-income Americans. Which brings up a third possibility, budget reconciliation. Republicans call it the nuclear option because it doesn't allow senators to filibuster and only requires 51 votes to pass. The bad news, says Hoagland, is that it would basically require lawmakers to start the process over again. A new health bill would have to go back through committees and floor debate.
This probably stretches it into the spring, but it clearly is an option that's still available to the president and to the Congress until a new budget resolution is adopted.
Hoagland says even the insurance industry, which opposes key elements of the bills now under discussion, wants to see something settled as soon as possible.
There comes a point when you just want some clarity on the so we can make plans going forward. And while, yes, there are things that the industry has not been happy with, there are other things that we've been prepared to get on with.
Things like eliminating restrictions on pre-existing conditions. Meanwhile, Ron Pollock of Families USA has come up with a plan D he thinks might work. He would have the House vote almost simultaneously on the Senate-passed health bill and a separate bill that would embody the negotiated changes. That second bill would be in the form of a budget reconciliation bill, which would only need 51 votes in the Senate.
This clearly works. I believe that it can happen quickly. And I think it can end up with a very good result.
And, says Pollock, it might even have an advantage over the current negotiations by letting some reluctant moderate Democrats in the Senate simply vote no.
So I think it frees up the negotiators to come up with an agreement that's more to the liking of the House and the Senate leadership and the president.
Of course, what Democrats really want is Plan A, for Coakley to win in Massachusetts, so they don't have to worry about any of these contingencies. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Now, a new book about presidential power. It's written by a man made famous, or infamous, depending on your political persuasion, for helping expand President Bush's powers after 9/11. He is John Yoo. From 2001 to 2003, he was a lawyer in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. When he was there, John Yoo wrote a number of controversial memos. They justified, among other things, the use of enhanced interrogation techniques and warrantless wiretaps. His new book is called Crisis and Command. I recently spoke with John Yoo about those memos, any regrets he may have, he does have one, and why he thinks it's important for a president to be so powerful.
We need a powerful president because we have periods of emergency, crisis, and even war where we need part of the government that can act quickly in response. That the powerful president isn't necessary all the time. It's someone who we need to come forward and address unforeseen events and circumstances.
You argue in the book that the greatest presidents come forward during times of crisis to do that, to seize power when they can and to expand the role of the executive.
That's right. You look at who most scholars think are our greatest presidents, men like Washington, Lincoln, and FDR. These are presidents who are no shrinking violets. They embrace their power. They use their powers vigorously to attack the challenges of their day and often or sometimes in direct conflict with the Congress and the Supreme Court. The other thing is that we have had bad presidents. And one thing I try to do in Crisis and Command is write about some of our bad presidents. And often they were people who, confronted by these same challenges, retreated and shrunk into a shell and asked Congress or the courts to take the lead.
But when we're looking at what is commonly called the war on terrorism, it's often seen as an unending war. And so how do these powers get put back in the bottle if you have an unending war?
I share your concerns. And it's a hard thing. How do we figure out when the war against al-Qaeda, the war with other terrorist groups is going to be over, when they're not a nation state, there's no territory to conquer, there's no armies to fight in the field? How do we know when the war is over? I think that's a very fair and difficult question, because it's that point when the president's powers will recede.
I wonder if you've reconsidered the validity of any of the measures that you supported in your memos just after 9/11. It was in the flush of this terrorist attack when feelings were running very high. It's now 8 years past. And I'm wondering, for example, with the approval of secret wiretapping, of not abiding by Geneva, of getting rid of habeas corpus, do you have any regrets?
Obviously, I think about it a lot. I think we should always have an open mind and, you know, be willing to reconsider evidence in new light to see whether we should have done something differently. The only thing I regret was just the pressure of time that we had to act under. The problem was we had to make all these decisions in such a short period of time under the pressure of circumstances. And, of course, one would always like the luxury to have more time to think it through. But I think under those circumstances, I probably would do the same things again.
You wrote, the definition of torture is the victim must experience intense pain or suffering of the kind that is equivalent to the pain that would be associated with serious physical injury so severe that death, organ failure, or permanent damage resulting in a loss of significant body functions will likely result. Where did you get that definition?
Well, when we did these memos in the Office of Legal Counsel, we looked at all kinds of sources. The particular language you read, we borrowed from another statute passed by Congress that contained a definition of what's severe pain and suffering. But we also looked at a lot of other things. If you look at those memos, they also look at foreign countries. They look at states. They look at past cases in the federal courts. I might add that since those memos, there's been a federal court of appeals based in Philadelphia that has adopted a definition that's quite similar to those memos.
The statute you mentioned, was that a statute governing treatment of prisoners?
I'd be the first to admit there was no statutes involving treatment of prisoners that was exactly on point. So I believe this statute involved Medicaid and Medicare, in fact.
Why would you pick this definition over any others?
Well, the problem is that one worries about picking something that's just purely subjective. And so one thing I think the Justice Department owed the people, the CIA, the people in the National Security Council and the White House who are asking us these questions was to try to be as clear as we could, to try to find a line.
So you found this one from a Medicare and Medicaid statute?
Yeah, I think, if you look at the memo in its entirety, it's not just that one definition. It fills it out. It provides examples of basically everything that the federal courts had found to be torture in other kinds of cases, and it provided list examples of things that the judges had found to be torture.
Even though waterboarding had been described as torture for many, many years, had been used by Pol Pot.
Well, one thing I'd say is that I think waterboarding is clearly, I think, the hardest question. It was the interrogation method. I think if you look at these other memos that were done, came closest to the line. I'll just say this. I think it's a very difficult question. And again, dire situations. It's not all the time, and it's not just for everybody. It's under these most, I think, emergency situations.
As you were writing this book and researching examples of executive power and what's happened during times of crisis, how did you compare the president you worked for, President Bush, with these other presidents? Where would you put him?
As you know, in the book itself, I don't want to take a position on where Bush will eventually fall out on the rankings of presidents, because it takes decades until we can really be sure. But I think that what I am the first to admit is that it really depends on whether what he did were appropriate to the circumstances.
What do you think personally?
I think President Bush probably will be, like a lot of our recent presidents, probably around the average. I mean, I think that's around where Bill Clinton and the first President Bush ended up.
Where do you think he made a mistake?
Well, I think certainly in the area of domestic policy, I think that there were problems. And you know, these are not areas I really worked on, but I think these are areas where I think the Republicans and the president overspent. They expanded federal programs too far. The Iraq War, obviously, is always going to be a question. I personally have never been certain. It was not my job at the time, obviously, but I was never certain whether the Iraq War made sense as a matter of strategy. I think, obviously, that could end up being a mistake, but it's still we're still in the middle of it.
John Yoo, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
John Yoo, his latest book is called Crisis and Command. He now teaches law at UC Berkeley.
This is NPR. The flake, the cream egg, the crunchy, the curly whirly. These are all brands of the British candy maker Cadbury's, now likely to be stamped with the brand Kraft. If Cadbury shareholders accept a takeover bid from the American company, the $20 billion deal will create the world's biggest chocolate maker. As Vicky Barker reports from London, many people in Britain are already mourning the loss of a national treasure.
Hello, this is Breakfast with Bill Turnbull and Sean Williams.
Britain's biggest chocolate firm could be swallowed up by the Americans.
After all-night talks...
It isn't just knee-jerk nationalism, not just that, anyway. Cadbury's holds a special place in many Britons' hearts. Even the famously unsentimental former British Trade Minister, Lord Digby Jones, couldn't hide his dismay at the deal.
My big wish is that Kraft get it when they see what made Cadbury the iconic brand they wanted to buy. And that's its people, its reputation. That's what Cadbury's is. And they're buying something that's more than just a chocolate company.
Almost from its beginnings in 1824, Cadbury has been more than just a chocolate company. Its founder, John Cadbury, came from a long line of wealthy Quakers. He believed chocolate drinks could woo the working class away from alcohol. In 1879, the Cadbury family created a model village for their workers called Bourneville in rolling countryside away from industrial smoke and fumes. Cadbury pioneered pension schemes and joint worker management committees and provided medical services long before socialized medicine came to Britain.
Midday break, the big punctuation mark in the day.
Generations of Britons grew up eating Cadbury's Dairy Milk Chocolate, Cadbury's famous cream egg, and other delights.
Haven't you heard of Cadbury's Caramel?
But ultimately, Cadbury fell to the desire of the world's candy companies to gobble each other up in a not-so-sweet quest to survive. 4 months after firmly rejecting a lower offer from Kraft, Cadbury's current chairman, Roger Carr, says the time and the price are right.
And I think Cadbury was exactly what Kraft needed, and indeed does need. I think providing our shareholders receive value, it's been a good outcome.
Prime Minister Gordon Brown today urged Kraft to hold on to Cadbury's UK workforce, but it's feared many, if not most, of the company's 4,500 British jobs may go. And this is one deal Cadbury's workers will not have a say in. In Bourneville today, someone's erected a sign saying, Kraft, go to hell. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.
Our program is directed by Curly Whirly Brendan Banizak, edited by Allison McAdam, and produced by Neil Carruth. The technical director is Stu Rushfield, and the engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
At the foreign desk, Lauren Jenkins, Ted Clark, Kevin Beasley, Douglas Roberts, Dee Dee Skanky, and Michael Kennedy.
Librarians include Denise Chen, Beth Howard, Janelle White, Maureen Clements, Joella Straley, Robert Goldstein, James Powell, and Lauren Sin.
Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Madeline Brand. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.